life for all of us. But we need to fight back.
All right. Thanks so much, both of you, for being with us on this debate. The head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajaei, out of London, and activist and commentator Mustafa Chaira out of Paris. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
These are the top stories. The United States is reportedly planning to impose new sanctions against Chinese officials over the situation in Hong Kong. Bahrain's opposition Al-Wefaq says Manama held a conference on regional and international security, while the country itself lacks public, religious, and political security. Also in the headlines, vote counting is underway in Venezuela's parliamentary elections, in which President Maduro's party is tipped to win a majority. The United States is reportedly planning to impose new sanctions against China. Sources familiar with the case have told Reuters that at least a dozen Chinese officials, as well as officials from Hong Kong, will likely be sanctioned. The sources say these people will be targeted by measures such as asset freezes and financial sanctions. The U.S. accuses these officials of playing a role in the disqualification of elected opposition lawmakers in Hong Kong. The U.S. has already imposed sanctions on China over Hong Kong. Beijing condemns such moves by Washington as interference in its internal affairs. We'll be giving you more on that story through the help of our man, Stephen Ribe, who joins us via Skype and standing by for us in the Chinese capital of Beijing. Stephen, I'm going to hand it over to you. What are we hearing on this?
Well, the daily press briefing of the foreign ministry hasn't started yet. It's going to start at 3 o'clock, but it's predictable, I think. They will say what they have always said. They will deny that they're curbing Hong Kong's freedoms. They will say they're still honoring the one country, two systems agreement that they made with the UK when Hong Kong was handed back. And more importantly, they will condemn the US for interfering with China's internal affairs. I think below that, there's an anxiety that Trump, who is known as being volatile in his personality, irascible, is very upset about being voted out of office, and he's going to take it out on China. So they're a little bit anxious that this is another one of Donald Trump's temper tantrums. On the other hand, they're also worried of Joe Biden, the incoming president, They're worried that he's under pressure now to display resolve early on in his term, and he's going to do so by getting tough on China. So this is the kind of thoughts on China, of China on this situation now. In Hong Kong, well, I think there's genuine fear now. Beijing said it would only apply this new national security law in very few cases. And there's what a lot of people feared was that it would go well beyond that for a complete suppression of the freedoms and the measure of democracy that the Special Administrative Region of Hong Kong has enjoyed since the handover. For a lot of people now, it seems that the real handover now is happening, and the one country, two systems, well, that's it's well and truly over. I mean, what counts as subversion, secession, terrorism, and colluding with foreign forces? This is an interesting question, because it's up to Beijing what these things amount to. I mean, I think that there was the pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong. I mean, he was in the U.S. meeting with senators like Marco Rubio and Tom Cotton. So it's very easy to say that he was colluding with foreign powers. But as for the four democratically elected legislators who were expelled last month under orders from Beijing, I mean, most people in Hong Kong say that China has gone too far, and that it's broken its pledge to only apply this new national security law in a very few cases, and that it's just going to be a kind of communist totalitarian hardline crackdown from now on. More generally, I think the interesting question is, how far are these sanctions going to go? I mean, you said it's going to be individuals, they're going to be banned from travel to the US, maybe their assets there are going to be frozen, but will it go farther? I think the interesting question here is the US is very, very keen on sanctioning countries which have much smaller economies than itself. But what happens when you try and apply financial sanctions to a guy who's around about your size? I mean, China's economy is about three-quarters, two-thirds of the size of America's now. You know, I mean, how far can America go employing this tool, which it is very keen to use on economies which are much smaller than itself? That's for me, a very interesting question now.
A very good question indeed, and that's an update from our man, Stephen Ribe, in Beijing. Thank you, Stephen. Bahrain's main opposition party, Al-Wefaq, has objected to the holding of a conference dubbed Manama Dialogue in the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. In an open letter to the participants of the event, the group lamented that the Bahraini people lack security in a country where a conference is held to discuss security conditions of the region and the world. Al-Wefaq National Islamic Society, which was outlawed by the government in 2016, stressed that the establishment is failing to address serious concerns regarding corruption and discrimination in the country. It added that the authorities are also following a policy of intimidation to quell domestic protests. The Manama Dialogue on Regional and International Security was held in Bahrain from December the 4th up to the 6th. Political commentator Colin Cabell says the Bahraini opposition's criticism of the Manama Security Conference highlights the hypocrisy of an autocratic regime that continues to stifle freedom of speech.
What this letter, this open letter by the Al-Wefaq National Islamic Society, a notable Bahraini pro-democracy opposition group, is saying is that they are criticizing these countries that are participating in this annual dialogue, supposedly that's what it's called, while closing their eyes to the autocratic regime of Bahrain as it continues to stifle freedom of speech, it arrests people arbitrarily, it gets rid of freedom of press, it eliminates freedom of belief, it jails, it tortures, and extrajudicially murders many of its citizens. So what the letter does is calls out the hypocrisy of these countries who claim they support humanity, who claim they support dialogue, when in fact this is only a monologue between imperialist states who are part of the UK-US coalition to wage war on the people of the Middle East.
The Venezuelan president calls on U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to lift all sanctions on his country.
I call on the entire opposition to abandon the path of extremism, to take advantage of U.S. President Donald Trump's defeat, to abandon the interventionist agenda of the United States. With one voice, we call on the new U.S. government of President-elect Joe Biden to lift all sanctions. Let's get back to all the mechanisms of national dialogue, and let's prepare an electoral agenda.
Nicolas Maduro made the remarks after casting his vote in parliamentary elections in which his Socialist Party is tipped to win a majority. Vote counting is currently underway. Opposition leader Juan Guaido had called on Venezuelans to skip the vote and instead participate in a consultation on December the 12th. The elections come amid a campaign of pressure by the U.S. and Europe to force Maduro out of office. A number of Western governments in 2019 recognized Guaido as Venezuela's self-declared president. Now, the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases worldwide has surpassed the 67 million mark. That's according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Data also suggests that the global death toll now stands at over 1,535,000. The United States remains the worst hit, with over 282,000 deaths out of over 14.7 million confirmed cases so far. Infections and deaths are skyrocketing all across the country, with figures indicating a daily average of over 190,000 cases and more than 2,100 deaths. The spike has prompted California to announce new strict lockdowns, with the state governor threatening to withhold funds from counties that refuse to carry out the restrictions. India and Brazil remain the top two other countries in terms of coronavirus cases. Russia comes fourth with over 2.4 million cases. NOPS correspondent in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, says California's Governor Gavin Newsom is facing an urgent situation considering the surge of in cases of COVID-19 in the state and his row with political, or I should say local, governments. Take a listen.
This is creating a very troublesome scenario for the Governor Gavin Newsom as California records 1.3 million cases of COVID-related illnesses in the state of California. He's faced with an urgent situation that he tries to address immediately. And when law enforcement is saying that they are not going to cooperate, this creates an even bigger problem for the governor. How does he get law enforcement to carry out his order? How does he reconcile the fact that he has officials working for him that are not carrying out his instructions? So this is a compounded problem for the governor. Meanwhile, you have people who are dying every day from COVID-19 related illnesses. California hit a record number exceeding the number of 25,000 people just the other day of people who had who were diagnosed with COVID-19. And so this is a very serious situation in California, and it's just a snapshot of the other of one state out of the 50 that are dealing with a COVID-19 crisis as we head into the holiday season. And of course, this is the time of year that many people are traveling. They want to see their loved ones. There are those who have defied the odds and have defied the recommendations of health officials who say that people should stay home.
Grim unemployment data in the United States has many admitting that temporary job cuts due to coronavirus lockdowns are increasingly becoming permanent. Long-term unemployment has had devastating effects on millions of households, yet the jobs report comes on the heels of the best November ever for stocks. Ramin Mazahiri is in Chicago.
It's being called the jobs report without a silver lining. United States corporate media is unable to put any positive spin on the number of new jobs produced in November, coming in at a whopping 60% under the initial prediction. It's the lowest monthly addition of jobs since April, coincides with a tripling in long-term unemployment since only September, and makes clear that temporary unemployment caused by coronavirus lockdowns have repeatedly led to permanent job losses.
The jobs report may be the final nail in the coffin of a so-called snapback economic recovery, which was so widely touted by the mainstream media last spring. A social recovery for the long-term unemployed and their dependents may prove to be just as difficult to achieve.
As seen following the 2008 recession in the U.S., the social effects of long-term unemployment include mental health problems, increased drug and alcohol addiction, an erosion of employable skills, and lasting family dysfunction. With stocks just having their best November ever, it's now clear that the U.S. has had a K-shaped recovery, with the rich and poor classes headed in opposite directions.
It's in shambles right now. There's no question about that. We're in the worst crisis for U.S. capitalism since the Great Depression. And this crisis isn't getting better. Bills are compounding. Rent is compounding. It's not like things are getting better. For people who haven't been able to work, they still have to pay. These numbers are still piling up. Medical bills are piling up. Utility bills are piling up.
The second wave of coronavirus has hit. Lockdowns and not more funding for health care is again America's solution. The new lockdowns are being called a gift to Amazon by small local business groups and will likely worsen the already bad unemployment situation, just as they did in spring. At the same time, pandemic stimulus unemployment benefits are scheduled to run out the day after Christmas for 15 million people.
We think unemployment benefits need to be extended to all who are out of work, and to be much, much more than they are now. We need paid sick leave, nationally for jobs, especially if someone is, coming down positive with COVID-19.
Data from MIT University estimated that the Paycheck Protection Program from the first and only federal stimulus plan spent nearly $250,000 to save each job. However, the maximum compensation to workers was capped at $100,000. The annual median personal income is just $33,000. It's caused many to wonder where the money for jobs really went. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Romanian Premier Ludwig Orban claims victory in Sunday's legislative elections, although his ruling party is trailing behind the main opposition party. Partial results released on Sunday show that the governing Liberal Party has garnered 25% of the vote, whereas the leftist Social Democratic Party has gained 30%. Even if the final results show Orban's party slightly behind rivals, he is expected to get the nomination from President Klaus Johannes to form a coalition government. That's mainly due to Social Democrats lacking allies in the parliament to form a majority coalition. Mr. Orban has been running a minority government for over a year now. And pressure is mounting on Italy to scrap a series of arms sales deals with Egypt worth billions of dollars. This comes against the backdrop of the unsolved murder of an Italian student near the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Press TV's Max Civili has filed a report from Rome.
The Italian government has come under fire from human rights groups and a number of domestic media outlets for continuing to secure huge arms deals with Egypt. From 2016 to 2019, Italian arms sales to Egypt jumped from about 7 million to more than 870 million euros. Recently, Cairo has purchased two Italian Fram Bergamini-class frigates for 1.2 billion euros.
Paradoxically, Italy's arms sales to Egypt have skyrocketed since the brutal killing of the Italian PhD student Guido Regeni in Cairo in 2016. Italy has sold 32 military helicopters to the Egyptian armed forces without consulting the parliament as required by law.
In February 2016, the body of 28-year-old Italian PhD student Giulio Regeni was found by the side of a road on the outskirts of Cairo, bearing signs of extensive torture. 2 months later, Italy recalled its ambassador from Egypt in protest at a lack of progress by Egyptian authorities in a probe into Regeni's murder. Some believe the reason why Cairo has, in recent years, consistently purchased more weapons, spare parts, and military software from Rome has been to sideline the investigation into Regeni's murder.
Egypt's arms markets becoming increasingly important for Italy. The appeasement policy with Egypt and the sales of arms to that country must stop now.
European Union foreign ministers have pledged to suspend export licenses to Cairo of any equipment which might be used for internal repression since 2013, the year of the Rabah massacre in which Egyptian security forces killed over 1,000 demonstrators. Italy is not the only European country that has broken that pledge, as a dozen of other EU member states have contravened the undertaking.
On September 17, a resolution issued by the European Parliament urged EU member states to impose an arms embargo on Cairo, fueled by concerns that European weapons and military equipment might be used for domestic oppression in Egypt. Most EU nations have completely ignored the resolution so far. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, that's it for me.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willest, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
As millions of Americans stand on the brink of economic annihilation, the money keeps flowing to Wall Street thanks to carefully contrived mechanisms to maintain a dying financial system afloat, says Raul Diego Ryder in an article published under the heading, "With rent freezes about to expire, Mnuchin lobbies for more Wall Street bailouts." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The United States Treasury Department keeps a stash of taxpayer money and uses it for currency speculation. The massive profits from the secret market activities can be used for things like funding foreign governments and many other applications at the discretion of the President administration. This slush fund was the central funding vehicle for the multiple economic relief facilities enacted in the CARES Act and is operated by the Federal Reserve on behalf of U.S. Treasury Department. The spigot from the money machine was opened briefly for the general public through the emergency legislation, but Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is getting ready to cut it off, even as he hopes he opens it even further for Wall Street. By January 2021, renters in America will owe $34 billion to their landlords, according to global investment bank and advisory firm Stout. More than half of the eviction moratoriums enacted to avoid an upsurge in homelessness during COVID lockdowns have been rescinded, including a federal moratorium that expired in July. Rent and landlord relief programs across the U.S. take up the lion's share of CARES Act funding allocations, with states like Virginia having already spent over 38% of the money reserved for renters by early November. As the money runs out and the December 31st CARES Act cutoff date approaches, states are
fumbling to keep enough cash in their coffers to stem the tidal wave evictions that are at the doorstep and leaking through profusely. Cases like that of Ricky Johnson, as reported by the Virginian Pilot, are happening nationwide and show how landlords are getting around moratorium rules and successfully evicting tenants over technicalities and dubious legal maneuvers. It was only through the efforts of a staunch group of friends and housing advocates that Johnson was able to avoid ending up on the streets with his brother. With their help, the Johnson brothers convinced a judge to vacate a previous order awarding possession of the property to a management company and managed to extend their stay of execution a paltry few weeks into next year. But in the rapacious economic climate that characterizes the American real estate market, 3 months rent-free can feel like a gift from the gods. Mnuchin was deliberately misleading about where that money actually goes, since it lays bare a massive slush fund called the Exchange Stabilization Fund, or ESF, at the heart of these enormous giveaways to the biggest, richest, and most ruthless banks. Of the total 13 facilities created by Treasury, Secretary Mnuchin had asked to spare only those which pertain to financial institutions like Citigroup and a handful of usual suspects. In a formal letter to Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell in late November, Mnuchin instructed the Fed to extend four programs directed at helping Wall Street beyond December, while drawing the curtain down on the remaining facilities and preening about programs like Main Street Lending Program and their supposed success in abating an economic downturn during the pandemic. Mnuchin's declaration of victory is at odds with the reality of people like Dana Imus, who lost her job at a forklift operator in March and hasn't been able to get a job since. Her landlord simply refused to recognize the federal eviction moratorium issued by the CDC in October. Similar problems occur throughout the U.S. as property owners circumvent the laws through intimidation and legislative loopholes to force tenants out. Tawanda Mormon from Cleveland, Ohio, was thrust into a couch-surfing lifestyle when the 46-year-old was hospitalized in August and fell behind on her $500 rent. Despite the CDC moratorium, Mormon was evicted in October and has been staying with friends and family. In Missouri and North Carolina, judges refused to abide by the CDC's notice, and landlords across the nation have been fighting the order in the court. Among the loopholes being used to put people out of their homes, that the CDC's order only applies to non-payment of rent, which allows landlords to bring an eviction case on virtually any other grounds, such as excessive noise or trash. In addition, the CDC made the process more onerous for tenants seeking to avail themselves of moratorium protections by giving landlords the right to challenge the veracity of their claims. Mnuchin's request that four credit facilities for the financial sector be spared the December 31st deadline while pulling the cord on all the relief programs for small businesses and regular Americans included in the CARES Act feels like politics, as an incoming Biden administration is set to use the coming housing crisis as a springboard for sweeping legislative action as potentially millions of people start to fall through the cracks come January. Meanwhile, big banks continue to receive their billion-dollar stipends from Uncle Sam without interruption. Two of the four programs Mnuchin won enough, the chopping block, are Zombies from 2008 Financial Collapse, the Primary Dealer Credit Facility, PDCF, which targets large banking institutions and back then extended $8.95 trillion in secret, below market rate loans to three trading houses, constituting two-thirds of the original program's total disbursements, and the Commercial Paper Funding Facility, CPFF, which makes the Fed the buyer of last resort for loans in broader economy, thereby providing liquidity in short-term funding markets like small business loans. The Money Market Mutual Fund Liquidity Facility, that is MFFL, directed at the hedge funds and non-bank financial entities, and the Paycheck Protection Program Liquidity Facility, which protects PPP loan originators from borrower default, round out the rest. Financial data for these programs are kept secret by the Fed, with the exception of the Paycheck Protection Program Liquidity Facility. According to Mnuchin's letter to programs whose data is verboten use core EFS funding. In other words, the money comes from a slush fund operated by the Fed on behalf of the Treasury Department and is where the aforementioned $429 billion Mnuchin is disingenuously requesting back from the Fed actually is. The shell game between Treasury and the Fed keeps the money flowing on Wall Street year-round. In September 2019, the Fed moved $9 trillion culminatively into Wall Street's trading houses via repo loans, whose recipients are hidden from the public by the Fed policy on its open market operations, which fund the loans. By using the ESF to fund the federal relief facilities contained in the CARES Act, the Treasury avails itself of the Fed's secrecy policy on open market operations, which don't have to be made public until 1 year after the facility is terminated at the earliest, as stipulated in Section 1103 of the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Legislation of 2010. Requesting an extension for the four Wall Street geared facilities until March 2021 also extends the time it will take for such records to see the light of day. According to Wall Street on Parade, it is likely that when disclosed, the financial data for these secret market operations will include the names of long-standing beneficiaries of government largesse. The point of the game is to prop up America's predatory financial sector, which has been going full throttle since 2008 financial crisis, when these types of facilities were created to prevent the country's biggest financial firms from going into a liquidity crisis as they scoured the globe for more markets to squeeze. Mnuchin's letter came 2 weeks after Democratic senators delivered a message of their own to the Secretary of the U.S. Treasury in which they called for two facilities in the CARES Act meant for the regular citizen, specifically the Main Street Lending Program, MSLP, and the Municipal Liquidity Facility, MLF, to be kept on and reformed. Signed by Senators Chuck Schumer, Elizabeth Warren, Mark Warner, and Sherrod Brown, the letter makes a case for the expansion of these financial assistance programs, citing statistics which reflect the permanent closure of thousands of small businesses and declining revenue across the service economy. The reality of crushing GDP numbers amid the pandemic tells the story. which includes a 41% decrease in the number of self-employed black business owners between February and April, and a litany of cases that show the disproportionate economic impacts on minorities and women caused by the pandemic and related restrictions. The senators shed light on some of the major problems regarding these facilities and how they are set up to bypass the most economically vulnerable populations by requiring applicants to meet an income threshold that leaves out the vast majority of working-class Americans. In addition, they point to the billions of dollars left unused in the relief effort which Mnuchin wants to keep in the ESF. Fed Chairman Powell is quoted in the letter acknowledging that the MSLP currently targets larger businesses rather than a lot of minority businesses. The senators called for reforms that would change this by lowering the application threshold from $100,000 to $50,000 and expanding eligibility criteria to open the funds to more than the paltry 250 businesses currently eligible for the MSLP facility. The fact that Mnuchin ignored the informed pleas of the Democratic senators is immediately chalked up to partisan politics. But a gesture of goodwill by the outgoing administration does not help cement the division both parties exploit to achieve the aims of the interests that ultimately control them. A desperate population facing evictions, food shortages, and falling income opportunities will find it difficult to resist any offers of federal help that come their way. It is, however, more important than ever, as Americans are sheep herded into a dark winter, that they keep their eyes open. The question is whether there will be a real justice behind any new programs or legislation brought forward to deal with a crisis that has been looming for a while.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Economic divide.
Known as an immigrant-friendly country, and it is America's neighbor to the north. It may have a charismatic prime minister to some, but what lies beneath the surface is our focus. That country, Canada, like many economies around the world, ravaged by COVID-19 pandemic. Here's the PM Trudeau with his stimulus plan announced back in March.
In these extraordinary times, our government is taking extraordinary measures. The measures we're announcing today will provide up to $27 billion in direct support to Canadian workers and businesses, plus $55 billion to meet liquidity needs of Canadian businesses and households through tax deferrals to help stabilize the economy.
Well, yet at that point that you heard, the depth of the problem was really not known. As it progressed, it got worse. For example, Montreal, stripped of the crowds of visitors that usually flock to its sites, to the Grand Prix, to its renowned festivals. Many businesses across the board in Canada were suffering, as you're about to see. Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavita Hawaii. In this week's episode, we will take a look at Canada's economy and some of its weak points, like income inequality, and how the impact of COVID-19 has had on that economy. Now down to some basic facts about how battered Canada's economy is. In late October, the governor of the Central Bank of Canada forecast that the economy would not fully recover until sometime in the year 2023. Of course, you need to keep in mind whether a vaccine will come along that would accelerate the pace of the recovery, which at this point, that may have already happened. On the other hand, if the economy weakens amid a second wave of infections, the central bank could, if necessary, cut the already record low interest rates. But will that help people spend money? That's the real question, isn't it? But this message from Prime Minister Trudeau was a reality check on how bad the COVID-19 situation actually is in Canada, something which obviously the government did not anticipate.
Canada has often been seen as a safe haven for immigrants, a multicultural and multinational country, which is actually a combination of Indigenous First Nations and waves of immigrants. But when it comes to equality, there seems to be a huge difference between white Canadians and non-whites. One of the major differences is the income gap. At the moment, Canada's income gap is at a record high. Experts say that there are two factors contributing to this growing gap: a widening disparity in labor earnings between high and low-paid workers, and less redistribution. Taxes and benefits also reduce inequality, less in Canada than in most countries.
When it comes to native people, well, like the Palestinians in Western Asia, you know, native people are indigenous to this territory, and this territory has been taken, in some cases, you know, violently and ruthlessly from the indigenous peoples, and they were pushed out of even citizenship. So the, you know, there's been a great theft of resources and wealth from the indigenous peoples, and it's been devastating in its effect on people's psychology, their ability to adapt to the current economy.
How bad is Canada's economy doing anyways? Maybe the question should be, prior to the COVID-19, was it underperforming? Well, don't take our word for it. Let's look at the Bank of Canada and what it has done. First, it has said that Canada's financial system is resilient. Yet a closer look reveals that there are high levels of household debt. And you guessed it, money that the bank has lent to households. Now, the central bank has also said that the longer the pandemic affects jobs and incomes, the greater the risk of financial trouble for households and businesses. Basically, that's another way of saying that risks to households, businesses, and markets actually remain. When it comes to businesses, the usual ones are the victims, like businesses in other countries across the world, including transportation, arts and entertainment, for example, accommodation, and food services. Now it's time to look at what has affected Canada's neighbor, the U.S., severely. Food insecurity.
Food insecurity is yet another challenge people in less privileged communities face in Canada. As some food banks are forced to close, daycares and schools close also, and paychecks stop. And people of all ages and backgrounds may face food insecurities. For those who were already food insecure, the situation is worse. A meal, let alone a nutritious meal, may not be accessible.
Disparities in the cost of living in different areas. It's very expensive to live in the Toronto area. It would be less expensive to live in, say, Regina. So the issue of minimal wage. This is important. We see a growing poverty. We see poverty in Canada, largely along the lines of, you know, Native people are at an extreme disadvantage in the economy.
Canada's minority groups, including the Indigenous populations, are now facing greater challenges. For example, overcrowding in housing makes social distancing, self-isolation, or quarantining an issue.
Far more heavily incarcerated. They go to jail at a much higher rate than blacks in the United States.
In northern remote isolated and urban Indigenous communities, there may be 10 people living in a space designed for two or three. Housing in disrepair also serves to support transmission of respiratory illnesses.
The resource-based economy, especially oil and gas. Oil and gas is very difficult. The price of oil and gas is very low. And there's been a great emphasis on building pipelines from the Alberta tar sands across the mountains so that the bitumen can be shipped to China.
Okay, today we have a special guest joining us for this edition of the program. His name, Robert Hux. He's a spokesman for the Committee for the Republic of Canada, Canada Liaison for Schiller Institute. He was also a contributor to the Canadian Patriot, News from the Northern Front, the edition which focused on Canada's struggle for nationhood and the Round Table Movement. Robert Hux, welcome to Economic Divide. First question, before the pandemic, Canada's economic indicators, they weren't that great, and now the pandemic has obviously affected the economy severely. The real GDP, according to one report, has fallen 18% in the 2 months, which none of the other four recessions actually even came close. Is that how bad Canada's economy is doing at this point?
Yes, well, what you're describing is this is not particular to Canada. All of the G7 countries were hit quite hard by the pandemic. Now, I think the question that should be asked is why were certain Asian countries, and particularly why was China able to deal with this pandemic so much better than the G7 nations, for example? Because this, you know, in late December of 2019, was a disease that was not clearly defined what it was. Very rapidly, China took the emergency measures so that that by the end of February, they had using public health measures and a huge mobilization, they had gotten the pandemic under control.
In terms of Canada's wages, there have been doubts that it has actually led to income inequality. Are Canadians not earning enough to actually cover their expenses? For example, Canada's rate per hour wage is $13.01, yet in Ontario, the rate is calculated to be at least $15.40 per hour.
Well, first off, the late economist Lyndon LaRouche emphasized that the only competent approach to economics is from the standpoint of what he calls physical economics. And in physical economics, you do not take as primary money. You do not take as primary even, for example, a factory producing, you know, X number of million tons of widgets per year. What you take as primary is the entire national economy, and on the larger scale, the entire world. And the question that that a physical economist has to answer is what are the measures that have to be taken by, for example, the government of my country in collaboration with the government of other countries around the world to ensure that 50 years from now, mankind is positioned to be able to meet the challenges that we will surely meet. Publication put out by Lyndon LaRouche's associates called the Executive Intelligence Review produced a special report in at the end of May of this year entitled The LaRouche Program to Reopen the Economy. The world needs 1.5 billion productive jobs. And it said if you take the figures that was that have been provided by the International Labor Organization, using figures from 2019, the world population is about 7.7 billion people. the labor force of the world is roughly 3.5 billion people. Now, if you look at the number of those 3.5 billion people who are employed in what's called formal jobs, formal employment, you add to that the number of people that are employed in the informal economy, you're looking at beyond that the number of people that are unemployed, and a fourth category, the number of people who might get a paycheck or might be collecting money, but are not doing anything of productive value for their nation or the world. For example, people selling cigarettes on a street corner, or what they call in the United States or Canada the gig economy. This could even include things such as hotels, restaurants, things that are not physically productive. And by productive, Mr. LaRouche means the production of the food, the raw materials, the intermediate goods required to physically reproduce, the ability to maintain the existing human population and allow for growth.
Final question, poverty, another economic indicator that's not going the right direction for Canada. February 2020, a report has said that the 2018 income tax return saying that 3.2 million Canadians were living below the poverty line, discrimination and systemic inequality rather than the lack of or poor individual choice to be the main reasons. Why is this the case, especially among the Indigenous, the visible minority, immigrants, and single-parent families?
Well, first off, as I said, you have to sort of look at this from a higher standpoint. One of the things that began occurring from the 1971 takedown of the Bretton Woods system on was the development at a later point of these free trade agreements, such as the North American Free Trade Act. Our organization put out a special report at that time entitled Auschwitz Below the Border, referring to the U.S.-Mexican border, because you were essentially creating conditions where people who were working in the United States at a certain higher wage associated with a skilled trade, these jobs fled to Mexico or eventually other places, including China at one point. Based on this idea, which is a British outlook of economics. The way to get wealthy, according to the British imperial outlook, is to buy something cheap and sell it very expensively. And if you control finance, if you can control transportation networks and so forth, that's the way that you supposedly get wealthy. But that precisely is the model that is now broken down. The coronavirus pandemic just exposed the underlying dysfunction of the entire world economy because of that. And so I think that we should be, if we were prepared to work with China and look at what they have actually done, just recently China has announced that the last remains of extreme poverty in China have now been eliminated. It's not that people are not poor in China, because they're talking about absolute poverty. But how did they do this? They did this through, in some cases, if people are living in mountainous, remote regions, it's very difficult to deal with the situation. They would move them to an area where they could get a productive employment. And Canada, as well as the United States, could learn some lessons from that kind of approach.
Okay, very well. Thank you very much for that. Robert Hux, the spokesman for the Committee for the Republic of Canada. All right, it's time for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. We have plenty more coming up in the next half of the program. Current affairs and impact analyst Mon Abedin will be joining us. He will share with us some posts such as wealth tax. Could that be the answer to Canada's economic woes? Also, look at how employment losses were greater for younger, low-wage, and non-unionized workers in Canada. And finally, a look at gender gap in the next half, and surprisingly how race plays an important role in income inequality. Hello, welcome back to Economic Divide. This is our in-depth section. When it comes to income inequality, the basic question we are asking is Canada becoming more unequal? We're going to set out the three findings that we came up with. First, is income inequality to have increased over the past 20 years. Second, richest group increased its share of total national income, while the poorest group lost its share. And finally, we're going to take a look at how Canadians in the poorest income group still saw their income levels rise, albeit minimally. Okay, now, the report titled The Affordability Education, written in 2019, discusses the rising concern about how the cost of living in Canada and how it presents a threat and opportunity to progressives, a report commissioned by the Broadbent Institute. Going on to what we thought was important here, you can see one in four Canadians cite financial issues, taxes, or housing as the thing keeping them up at night. Moving on to the next, cost of living, housing affordability, wages, inequality, and taxes. Well, these are things that are actually vote drivers. 57% rank an issue tied to the cost of living, wages, or taxes as their top issues. Moving on to the next finding that we have here, almost half of Canadians are worried about their cost of living. It's broken it down, asking a question how worried Canadians are, and it says women are more worried than men. Concern crosses all age groups, however, and that worry is directly related to household income. So we can see how household income obviously has an effect when it comes to the economy. And here, again, cost of living, in terms of how worried Canadians are about it, it's broken it down to the level of income from 35,000 moving upwards, 35 to 50, 50 to 75, all the way up to 150,000K. And of course, you can see the trend that exists here. And what this means is that, well, Canadians are worried about their cost of living. They want to have enough income to pay for things that they want in life, things such as rent, such as everyday